Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
Hello, here we are again, and I hope you've had a good week. Let's start with what might seem a silly little poem today. It is titled Passing the Buck Down the Line, and it goes like this. Said the community college instructor, such poor ability in a student is a shame. Lack of preparation in high school's to blame. Said the high school teacher, good heavens, that boy's a fool. The fault, of course, is with the junior high school. The junior high school teacher said, from such stupidity may I be spared. They sent him up to me so unprepared. The primary teacher huffed, kindergarten blockheads all. They call that preparation? Why, it's worse than none at all. The kindergarten teacher said, such lack of training never did I see. What kind of woman must that mother be? The mother said, poor helpless child, he's not to blame. His father's people were all the same. Said the father at the end of the line, I doubt the rascal's even mine. Now, in our last program, you might remember we talked about the horrors of making excuses and passing our responsibilities on to others. And I thought this poem, trifling as it might appear, makes a good sense for not passing the buck. No one, even down to the parents, wants to take any responsibility for the child, which means no one wants to address his problems and possibly difficult behavior. How then is he supposed to grow into an adult? And won't he just lock into the same behavior when his children come along? Remember that last week we saw research indicating that passing the buck is contagious. Talking about passing the buck when it comes to children, I came across a thought-provoking article on just this subject on LinkedIn by a head of a department at the Federal Polytechnic in Bauchi in Nigeria, which I'd like to read here. Her name is Sesanya Mercy Elaho, and she has titled her article, Don't Pass the Buck, Pass the Baton. And this is what she says. Recently, I was privileged to carry out a very important academic activity in conjunction with an erudite senior professional in my field of expertise. It was an awesome learning experience as I watched this great human repository of knowledge, pardon my coinage, deftly accomplish the assignment at hand. In the process of working together, we had some very deep and thought-provoking discussions that bordered on the past, present, and future of our profession. This savant applied knowledge from a wide spectrum of disciplines, including history, geography, law, chemistry, physics, biology, philosophy, engineering, pharmacy, medicine, mathematics, technology, and general spheres such as international relations, culture and civilization, native intelligence, and human interpersonal relationships in answering my questions, and I was so deeply impressed. When it dawned on me that this widely traveled pundit would be retiring from active service in a couple of years, I asked him one key question. Is there anyone whom you have poured all of this knowledge into and that you have groomed to take over from you? The answers I got actually fired up my concerns about the future of intellectualism in my country. Firstly, our academic system got the blame. You know, these days our institutions of higher learning hardly produce graduates who have the capacity for this level of thought and productivity due to their faulty educational backgrounds at the primary and secondary levels, fraudulent means employed in passing the entrance and other examinations, and very poor human, physical, and systemic infrastructure at all levels. And secondly, young people got their own share of the blame. Another issue is that you can't even find young people who are serious and who can be thorough in accomplishing assigned tasks. The other day, I asked a young employee in my office to prepare a report, and he messed it up so badly that I decided that I would rather do things myself than commit them to incompetent, irresponsible young fellows who were not interested in anything but money. And then I cast my mind back on my teen daughter's question to her dad some weeks ago. Daddy, why does your generation always say our generation is wasted? Many of our teachers and other adults always accuse us of being unserious, careless, and useless. They keep reminiscing about the good old days And we get to feel that everything about us and our time is bad. Our immediate reaction to this is not to make any effort to do things right, because no matter how hard we try to excel, we will always be concluded as irresponsible. After this conversation, my husband and I did a lot of soul searching, and we concluded that our generation and those before us have always passed the buck. We've always shifted the blame for the deplorable state of affairs to the government, teachers, the academic system, the students, everything and everyone else but ourselves. We did not realize that it is our failure as individuals, parents, teachers, older professionals and so on to transfer the knowledge, values and experience we required to the younger generation that has degenerated to the level of societal decadence which we now complain about. She goes on to say that the senior colleague she had spoken of previously had found that the root of the problem lay in African history and ethos. Ancient herbalists, who had been the doctors of their time, had been fiercely competitive with each other, and each had guarded the ingredients and makeup of these remedies diligently. And so when they died, so did their medicines and knowledge. Sasanya Elahol says that in contrast, Western philosophers and scientists had been very open about their discoveries. And so, and I quote, knowledge and development thrived and spread. They have succeeded in passing the baton successfully to younger generations who are building solidly on this rich heritage. Yes, maybe knowledge has been passed down and we have developed at a fast rate. But do our children feel any more secure than Sasanya Elahol's kids? Perhaps in other ways, we have also passed the buck on our children with a similar disempowering result. I think we can take her next words to heart for ourselves as well. She says, "My drift is this. My generation is sandwiched between the older and the younger generations, so we can broker some understanding between them. It is high time we stopped indicting others for the dysfunction in our society. It is imperative that we stop blaming the younger generation for their ignorance when the responsibility is ours to teach them. It is pertinent that we stop castigating the ones who need our guidance and direction to steer the course of their lives aright. We have a responsibility to inspire them to become avid readers with a vast knowledge base beyond their specific tracks of interest. We need to assign responsibilities to juveniles. We need to teach them how to think independently and strategize on how to accomplish tasks and give them space and opportunities to perform these assignments. We need to watch by the sidelines as they execute the tasks. They need space to make some mistakes while trying to accomplish targets. We need to help them think through all their learning and help them build their intellectual capacity. We need to stop assuming that they are deliberately being irresponsible. We need to challenge and inspire them to surpass their own previous achievements and root for them while they're at it. We need to commend them when they excel. We need to correct them in love when they go wrong. We need to encourage them when they are discouraged. We need to be patient with them when they are proving difficult. I have a great joy as a teacher seeing students move from the lowest percentiles to higher levels of achievement through hard work, patience, and gentle insistence. So I know it is possible. I'm glad to have been mentored by wonderful people all through my life, so I've committed myself to doing the same. Let's do this together. Don't pass the buck, pass the baton." Now that is pretty direct, and perhaps advice we can modify and use for any situation, not only those involving children. Okay, so we have gone nearly halfway through the program without thinking about motivation. So let's take a moment to do that now. And of course, let's make it a bodhicitta motivation. That is, we are participating in the program so we can become enlightened to benefit all living beings. A great motivation will give a great result, and this is the greatest motivation, so let's go for that. But if you can't, at least think that the program will lead to your own liberation. Thank you. Now back to the theme of passing the buck, and if you were with us before, you may remember that it comes out of a mind training slogan in the text Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun by Namkha Pel. This text deals mainly with developing bodhicitta and its related practices, with slogans to help us remember what to do and what not to do. One of the slogans is, "Don't place the load of a horse on a pony," or in Tibetan, "Don't place the load of a dzo onto an ox," the dzo being a stronger animal than the ox. And we've seen from various commentaries that this covers a number of meanings, among which is "do not pass the buck." Now, this is the meaning taken by the well-known Tibetan teacher of last century, Chogyam Trungpa. He translates the slogan as, "Don't transfer the ox's load to the cow," in his book, Training the Mind and Cultivating Loving Kindness. And he writes, "The ox is capable of carrying burdens. The cow is less capable of carrying burdens. So the point of this slogan is that you do not transfer your heavy load to someone who is weaker than you. Transferring the ox's load to the cow means not wanting to deal with anything on your own. You don't want to take the responsibilities. You just pass them on to your secretary or your friends or anybody you can just order about. In English, this is called passing the buck. Doing that is a bad idea, since we are supposed to be cutting down chaos and creating less traffic in the samsaric world altogether. We're supposed to be cutting down on administrative problems and trying to sort things out. We could invite other people to be our helpers, but we cannot pass the buck to them." Now, in saying we are supposed to be cutting down chaos and creating less traffic in the samsaric world altogether, we're supposed to be cutting down on administrative problems and trying to sort things out, Chogyam Trungpa is talking about the way a bodhisattva should behave. Of course, we should all be trying to cut the chaos and the traffic in the samsaric existence, but this is especially the work of bodhisattvas. Chogyam Trungpa's equally well-known disciple, the nun Pema Chodron, also uses his translation, "Don't transfer the ox's load to the cow," but is a bit more specific in her commentary in Start Where You Are, A Guide to Compassionate Living. She writes, "Let's say you're Juan's boss. When something comes along that you find unpleasant and don't want to do, you pass it on to Juan. You pass the burden to someone else. It's like that Greek myth about Atlas. He was just walking along innocently, and somebody said, 'Oh, Atlas, would you mind for a moment just holding the earth?' We do that. When we don't like it, it doesn't occur to us to actually work with that feeling and communicate with the person who's asking us to do this, or somehow open up the situation and work in an honest, fearless way with what's going on. Instead, we just give our burden to someone else and ask them to hold it." And she also calls it passing the buck. Now, Atlas, the analogy is a little skew. And if you're interested about the Greek myth she mentions, it concerns Hercules and the Titan Atlas. In a previous time, the Titans and the Olympians, which included all the Greek gods like Zeus and so on, had got into a battle with each other. The Olympians won, and in the tradition of the time, gave their enemies various punishments. Atlas's punishment was to hold the sphere of the heavens, not the world, on his shoulders for eternity. When Hercules came along, he needed Atlas's help to accomplish one of the 12 labors he had to do, and that was to get the golden apples from the Garden of the Hesperides, guarded by the fierce 100-headed dragon Ladon. So, while Atlas went to get the apples, Hercules held the sphere of the heavens on his shoulder for him. Atlas returned with the apples, but then said he wasn't going to take the sphere of heaven back from Hercules. It was Hercules's turn to carry it. Oh, Hercules agreed, but asked if he could just get a pad for his shoulders to make it easier to carry the sphere. So Atlas took the sphere back, but of course Hercules took the apples, said cheers, and disappeared, never to return. That is what really happened in Pema Chodron's reference to Atlas. Now, interestingly here, she doesn't only imply that we shouldn't try to pass the buck like Atlas, but shows us a way of dealing with our experience so that we don't pass the buck. She says, when we don't like it, it doesn't occur to us to actually work with that feeling and communicate with the person who's asking us to do this, to somehow open up to the situation and work in an honest, fearless way with what's going on. Instead of immediately reacting to our fear or of being overwhelmed by what we have to do, she suggests leaving aside the situation for a while and focusing on the actual feeling that we're going through. In fact, if we look at what is making us pass the buck, it's our reaction and not the actual situation itself, isn't it? So if we can, as a pure observer, become completely aware of what we're going through, we cannot be taken over by the reactive emotion. Jiddu Krishnamurti, the great Indian non-philosopher, describes it like this. Trying to control, suppress, or sublimate emotions and attachments in no way reduces the conflict, does it? Are one's emotions so extraordinarily strong that they act? First, one has to be conscious, aware, to know or to recognize, to see that one's emotions are strong, and also that one is attached. So awareness of your emotions, your attachments, is part of your nature, part of your structure. If you are looking at yourself, there is no division. There's no duality as the me and attachment. There is only attachment. Not the word, but the fact, the feeling, the emotion, the possessiveness in attachment. That is a fact. That is me. So what am I to do with a me? When there was division between me and attachment, I could try to do something about it. I could try to control it. I could say, I must suppress it, which is what we do all the time. But if it is me, what can I do? I cannot do anything. I can only observe. Before, I acted upon it. Now, I cannot act upon it because it's me. All I can do is observe. Observation becomes all important, not what I do about it. So there is observation, not I am observing. There's only observation. If in that observation I begin to choose and say I must not be attached, I've already moved away. I am now saying that this is not me. In observation there's no choice, there's no direction, there's just pure absolute observation, and then the thing that is being observed dissolves. Before, you resisted it, you controlled it, you suppressed it, you acted upon it. But now in that observation, all energy is centered. It is only when there is the lack of that energy that there is attachment. When there is complete observation without any interference of thought, why should thought come in? You are just observing as you observe the thing that you call the fly. Just observe in the same way your emotions and attachments. Then there is the gathering of all energy in that observation. Therefore, there is no attachment. It is only the unintelligent who are attached. It is only those who do not see the full implications of attachment who are attached. They pervade the world. They are the stronger element in the world, and we are caught in that. But when you come to examine this closely, then you are no longer caught in that, and you're no longer dissipating energy in something which has no meaning. Your energy is now centered completely in observation. Therefore, there is total dissipation of attachment. Test it. Do it, and you'll find out. You have to examine the thing very, very closely so that your mind is absolutely clear in the observation. It is only the unaware who jump over the cliff. The moment you are aware of danger, move. Attachment is a danger because it breeds fear, anxiety, hate, and jealousy. Being possessed and being not possessed, the whole of that is a tremendous danger. And when you see that danger, there is action. That's Krishnamurti. Now, if you see the danger you're in, you don't ask somebody else to jump out of the way, do you? You have to do the jumping. So what he's suggesting here is that we become intricately aware of what we're going through and deal with it, and not try to become comfortable by passing our discomfort on, especially to those who are less well-equipped to deal with it. In Brian Beresford's commentary on the text Advice from a Spiritual Friend, he uses the slogan translation, do not load an ox with a load of a dzol, and says, in other words, we should not unload our responsibilities onto others who are not capable of carrying them. The dzol is a Tibetan animal similar to the yak, used for heavy work such as plowing and transporting goods over long distances. If an ox is given the load of a dzol, it cannot carry such a burden. In the same way, we should not pass on difficult tasks to someone who is slightly stupid and does not realize our malicious intentions. Such an action will only relieve us temporarily of a responsibility that will reappear with even more strength in the future. The law of causality is unfailing. In other words, he is invoking the law of karma to say that if we pass our work on to others, especially not as strong as ourselves, we will only be making things easy for ourselves in the short term, and in the future, we'd better be ready for some Atlas-like work for ourselves. Another problem is that we will easily habituate ourselves to offloading responsibilities, thus creating more and more difficulties for the future. Theodore Roosevelt once said, "If you could kick the person in the pants responsible for most of your trouble, you won't sit for a month." And on the website feelhappiness.com, the author Mikey D takes this quote to introduce a blog titled "Take Personal Responsibility for Your Life and Your Happiness." Mikey D is not a professor of anything that I can see, but he describes himself as a fiend for self-development, and his blog has something pertinent to say about our topic today. He writes, "Ancient Romans understood the concept of personal responsibility. After a Roman arch was completed, the engineer who built it had to stand underneath it when the scaffolding was removed. While you might not get crushed by a giant arch if you make mistakes, you still have personal responsibility for your actions. What is personal responsibility? It is taking conscious control of your responses to the events and circumstances in your life. You are responsible for yourself, whether you like it or not. What you do with your life and what you've already done is up to you." "But Mike, things happen to me that I have no control over all the time." "Yeah, sure. And while you may not be able to control everything that happens to you, you are nevertheless responsible for how you think, act, and feel in response to those things. Responsibility cannot be split. If you give someone else any of the responsibility, you take it off yourself and can use it as an excuse to slack off when the going gets rough. Do you think the engineers in ancient Rome shared responsibility for their creations? Traditionally, we have viewed the notion of responsibility in a negative way. It's a matter of obligation or having duties. Ain't nobody got time for that. But, as I will argue, accepting personal responsibility for your life is actually quite liberating. There may be no more impactful thing you can do for yourself than to take responsibility for your life. And there are all sorts of benefits that you will realize, and I will go over the most important ones here." He then starts off with freedom and says that when we take personal responsibility for our lives, we can create any life we want. He says, "When you admit to yourself that you are solely responsible for your life, you immediately recognize how much control you really do have. Any goal that you want to achieve is within your control, and external circumstances don't control your fate. Personal responsibility is also the foundation for personal development in general. By acknowledging your role in the process, you give yourself the opportunity to improve." Then he mentions that taking personal responsibility will gain the trust and respect from others. "Let's say you make a mistake while working on a project at work," he posits. "If you admit your mistake, people are more likely to believe you about the other things you do. Your word has more meaning to other people when you take responsibility. But it's not just a matter of trust. You also earn lots of respect when you take responsibility for your actions. It is rare for someone to willingly and without hesitation confess up for their mistakes. So when you do, you will stick out. If you develop a reputation for being the guy who accepts responsibility for his actions, people will often simply ignore the fact that you made a mistake altogether." He then goes on to say that we will also experience fewer negative emotions and writes, "There are all sorts of negative emotions that come with not accepting personal responsibility. When you blame others, you may feel anger or resentment towards that person. You will almost invariably feel guilty or ashamed. The worst part about denying responsibility is an overall sense of powerlessness. When you feel like you don't have control over your life, you can easily become depressed." But he admits that it's not easy to take responsibility for your life and lists some roadblocks along the way, particularly related to ego maintenance. And the first is blaming others. He says, when something goes wrong, do you immediately look for some external culprit? It doesn't really matter whose fault it is anyways. What happened, happened. The question now is, how are you going to respond to it? Unfortunately, all too many people fall into the trap of responding by blaming someone else for the problem. They shift their own responsibility onto someone else and judge the other person for having failed. But, he says, blaming others means our ego might feel a little bit better, but it doesn't relieve us of responsibility. The fact remains that you didn't do what you had to get done, regardless of whose fault it was, he says. Now it's just that much harder to move forward and respond in a productive way. You spend your energy focused on the wrong thing, like resenting another person, when you could use that energy to advance in your goals. Then he talks about making excuses and says, when on projects, we often form backup excuses in case we fail. He writes, for example, I want to get 1,000 subscribers to this blog by the end of the year. If I fail, I already know what my excuse will be. I was busy working on other things and couldn't work full-time on this blog. This gives me an easy way out, and I can avoid the responsibility of the failure, which hopefully doesn't happen. Obviously, this is an unhealthy way of thinking. Success or failure in that goal is on me and no one else, regardless of external circumstances. And by taking responsibility and recognizing this, I am more likely to take the necessary actions to succeed. Then he lists complaining, a focus on what is wrong. Complaining makes things seem worse than they are and easily distracts us from all the good things in life. It can easily become a habit, leading to seeing everything in a negative light and not making any changes. He says, the more you complain, the easier it becomes to not take personal responsibility. A useful technique to combat regular complaining is to reframe your thoughts. He says, blaming others, making excuses and complaining may well lead to a victim's mentality, the opposite of taking personal responsibility. We surrender control over our life to external circumstances because we see ourselves as having no influence. He admits we all feel like that occasionally, but we shouldn't make it a habit. Once you are experiencing learned helplessness, he says, it becomes very challenging to take personal responsibility. And with that, we'll have to stop today as time is up. Please dedicate as usual to gaining enlightenment to benefit all living beings. Thanks for being with us today, and I hope you'll tune in again next week. But for now, it's time to say goodbye.
104.6.